session number 18258, Reel 7.
Wrench Dance, Reel 7.
Yes, the train kept stopping and it needed some sort of repair. And the three chaps up on the engine, they had to do all the repair work. So we'd often stop for several hours before we moved on. And outside was this desolate, flat countryside covered in snow, freezing cold. And but eventually the engine would start up again, we rumbled off. And then we stopped once again, it must have been several hours later, and it was getting darkish, and we stopped, and we heard voices outside. Now, we couldn't see any sign of habitation anywhere, but when we opened the door, there were three or four Russian women with children trying to wrap in little shawls, begging for food or blankets, you know, and we had nothing ourselves, but what we had, we broke bits off here and munched them, given to the kiddies, first of all. And one or two blokes said, well, there's a blanket over here, but it's full of holes and it's covered in lice. I said, but they'll want it. And they knew what to do. They laid it on the snow first to kill the lice off. And then we moved off. But where they came from, we couldn't fathom, because you'd expect there to be some hovels nearby, but we couldn't see any. We went on and on and on, and then, I don't know, but we got the impression we were just about near the Soviet or the Russian frontier, and the train stopped yet again. And by now we were getting used to it, so those who were fit and well enough used to slide the doors open and get out and walk up, even up towards the engine, you know. And the idea was, you know, try and get some hot water from the engine, but it was full of oil and you couldn't drink it. But they tried it once, and they'd carry out a bit of minor repairs to a valve or something, because these were all steam trains, and the only fuel was timber that they picked up from the wayside. And off we went again. Then we had another stop, and it was a really lengthy one, and the wind was blowing like mad, so no one went outside. And then suddenly there was a tremendous crash, and our carriage leapt up off the rails and went back down again. You know, what the hell was that? Then we heard shouting and got the door open, and the lads were all starting to run back to the back of the train. And it turned out that we'd stopped before and then we'd pulled away, but a coupling must have come undone. So that the bulk of the train went with the engine and this last two carriages were stuck behind. But we were on a very gentle down slope. You could barely see it, but obviously. And those two must have started off slowly. Probably the wind triggered them off. They wouldn't know what was pulling them along. But we'd gone on for 2 or 3 hours and then come to a stop. And they'd hit us at alarming speed. And the net result was we got in there and the stove was over, laying on top of a bloke. And we got them out and there were seven dead in there. And our lads who'd come all through them, and one of them was a warrant officer in the Royal Marines who I'd spoken to, and he was taken prisoner on the raid on the Lofoten Islands early in the war, you know, and he'd seen the war through there and he was still fit and well, and he was killed. And we buried them roughly on the side of the railway and had to leave them. After the war, since then, and through my regimental magazine, we found a man who researched graves who said, yes, I can add to Reg Dance's story. I can give the names of those people, warrant officer so-and-so, Royal Marine, and their graves are now inside Poland at this place, you know. Anyway, we rolled on, and eventually someone said, well, this is a big city or something, but it was all smashed up. That was Odessa on the Black Sea. So we'd reached Odessa and the port there. We were shepherded out of the trucks and marched into a big old warehouse down on the dockside, which had no roof to it, but there was shelter from the wind with the walls. And we were herded in there, and they put a guard round us, Russian guard, that was far stronger than any guard we'd had in Germany. So that made us think, We got some food from them, some very watery soup and some rough bread, but it was food and that's all we wanted. And we tried to make ourselves comfortable, and we spent at least one night there in those conditions, huddled together to try and get warmth, you know. And the next morning, someone said, "Oh, look at this." And there was an officer coming towards us, an RAF officer, in uniform, smart, well-fed. And he came right up to us and he said, "Well, hello, lads." He said, "For God's sake, don't upset the Russians. Don't do anything to make them think anything. Just stay here quiet." He said, "My job is I've been put into this port as a representative of the British government to get you prisoners out." He said, "There's not just you, there's a lot of others who've been here a couple of weeks." And he said, "But everything depends on a ship berthing here with Russian prisoners on board it." Now, they must have been the infamous Russian prisoners taken somewhere near the Czech border who deserted the Russian army, I think, in the end, you know. And, well, the Russians accused them of being cowards and all the rest of it. Anyway, that was it. I had to wait for that. He said, "Meanwhile, if I can, I'll try and get a little message out, but nothing long." And I was near him, and I said, "Well, Mrs. C. Dance, you know, 19 Abergrove, Abbey Wood, London, SE2. Safe and well, don't worry, Reg." I said, "If you can get that out, that'll be enough. And if you could get it to my deceased wife's family, that would be even better." And my mother heard via the Red Cross, and I've got the Red Cross telegram, which said, "British Red Cross picked up the following message from Radio Odessa. Safe and well, don't worry, Reg. Believe intended for you," you know. So the message did get out. And that was the first time my mother knew that I was still alive, you know. I was reported missing, believed killed. Right, well then, the boat did arrive. And we were all marched down to the dockside and then halted. And as we were waiting, we could see these passengers off the boat coming off, and they were all in battle dress. And they all went into a big bombed out warehouse down that end. Now this is absolutely true. About 2 hours later, a lot of figures came out in rags. They were the people who were in the battle dress. And they marched past us looking really forlorn, you know. I think they were all shot almost straight away, you know. And all that money for those boots, battle dress, everything, given to them to get off the boat and to wear, but all taken off them. And there was an old Russian woman near us, shivering, staring at us. And I said, "Oh, Mick, anyone got a blanket left?" They said, "Well, here's there." I said, "Well, we should be on that boat in no time. Give the old lady the blanket." And we got two. Gave it to her and she hurried away. And the next thing, someone said, "Oh, God, look at that." And I said, "What?" Turned round. And this bloody guard had hit her with a rifle and took the blankets away from her and kicked her up the arse and sent her on. So that was that. Anyway, they put a table down along the quayside about 100 yards from us and about 150 yards from the boat. And we were called forward one at a time. And each one spent about 10 minutes at the table, so it took up a long time. And eventually my name was called, and I went down and then I found out what it was. I looked at them. The young flight lieutenant RAF was sitting there. All the rest were Russians, but one of them could speak English. And the Russian said, "Right, your name is?" And I told him. He said, "What's your number?" And I said, 6018787, like that. He said, "Right. Now this, that, now," and then suddenly he came back and he said, "Now, what did you say your number was?" He said, "You told me 610. I said, "No, I didn't. 6018787. No, you did not." But to his credit, the young RAF bloke said, he definitely said 601. "Look, I've got it written down here as well." And this little argument went on for a little while, and then he won his day and he, you know. And then I had to walk towards the vessel. and there were blokes all up on the deck, merchant seamen. There was a gangplank down, and they had plenty of blokes up at the top of the gangplank because the tide was, the water was high, and the plank was like that, a fair old angle. Difficult for me to get up. I got there, and at the bottom of the plank, of course, were two Russians with their machine pistols folded across like that, so I couldn't get through. And they were just staring at the table that I'd come from. And they kept me there for about a minute. Then they must have got the nod, and they moved it away. And as soon as that happened, the bloke said, "Come on, mate, up here quick." So I stumbled up the old gangplank. They pulled me on board, and they said, "Come on, down below, we've got a meal waiting for you." Lovely. I got down there, and there was this china plate with a big fat pork chop on it, a couple of potatoes and some cabbage. I ate half of a potato, and I couldn't eat any more. And they said, "There's some beer there." I just had a sip, and I couldn't eat. By then, my stomach must have been the size of a lemon, you know. It just wouldn't take the food. So, anyway, we all got on board, and eventually she pulled away the ship, and we headed south. And, of course, the moment we started moving south, it started to get a little warmer. And we went down through the Bosphorus into the Straits by Dardanelles. And we pulled in at Istanbul. God, it was called Constantinople when we got there, but it's Istanbul now. And I always remember getting up on the deck and feeling the warmth of the sunshine and looking over at the water in the harbour there. And it was full of jellyfish. And I thought, I wouldn't want to swim down there. Because by then we were being given measured quantities of reasonable food. And I was being given tablets. But when I first got on board, I was examined. And the doctor said he had no idea what was wrong with my knee. But it might go down if I'd managed to last that long. He couldn't see any poison or anything. He asked me if I'd had fever at all, rheumatic fever. I said, not to my knowledge. Kept sounding my heart. And then he weighed me, and I was 7 stone. Now, at that time, I used to weigh 12 stone, 4 pound. And I was down to 7 stone. So I was just bones. I could see I was, you know. My thighs had withered away. And he put me on some pills to try and make me eat more, and vitamins and all manner of things. And I did start to recover on the boat, and it was wonderful to be free. And of course, once we got right into the Med, it was quite warm. Then we pulled into Naples, and we took on board a lot more ex-prisoners of war, came out and joined a convoy and headed for home. Came in to Scotland, back down on the train to London. We were sorted out. I was put on a truck with others. We went out to was either High Wycombe or Aylesbury, I think it was High Wycombe, and we were trucked down to a camp down there, an army camp, you know, and we were given further medical examinations, including a mass x-ray, and they said, "Well, take it easy, go back, sort yourselves out, but if your name's called on the tannoy, you've got to come back and have an enlarged x-ray." Because the first name I had called out was mine. Now they were x-raying for TB. And when I got down there and saw this doctor, I said, "Well, I've got a wound in my back." He said, "Oh, it wouldn't be that." I said, "But the wound in my back is right on the top here, on top of my right lung. And I was operated on quite crudely and messed about in the top of the lung." And he said, "Well, the shadow's there." So he took a look at my back. And because it was still open, it wouldn't heal because I wasn't... Well, I wasn't fit. I hadn't got the food in me. And he said, "Well, it's that. Right, forget it. Go back and get ready for some leave. Otherwise, I'd have been whipped off to some TB sanatorium," as indeed a lot of them were. So I came home on double ration card and that, and lived with my mother for a while, and slowly put on weight. And then they gave me, because I had about 6 months to go to leaving the army, I was given a job in the War Office in London, at the Military Secretary's office, confidential reports on officers, adverse reports, which was an interesting time, and it saw me out and helped me a lot, you know, and helped my poor old mum. And that was it.
Did you make a full recovery from your...
I took a long time, because I then started to have psychological problems, you know. I went to the military hospital at Millbank because I was almost passing out every now and again. And I was examined there, and the chap, the only one I had faith in was a colonel. And he said, "Well, think about it, lad." He said, "You were living a life at the highest possible level. Excitement, day after day, absolutely geared up, full of adrenaline, looking for the next challenge. And then suddenly, you're dropped off the edge of the cliff, prisoner of war, and then starving in Russia." He said, you've come unhinged mentally a bit, you know. So he said, "You've got to start eating plenty of eggs, raw if you can eat them." And all this sort of thing. I said, "Well, eggs are rationed. My poor old mum only gets one a fortnight, you know." "Well," he said, "get them if you can, you know, go out in the country and get them. But you will get over it," he said, you know, but it took a long time. And I received a pension for my wound, and it was described as gunshot wound, right shoulder, and psychoneurosis or something, you know. But the years went on, and I used to have a check-up medical with the pensions board. And after about, I think it must have been 12 or 15 years, they said to me, "We think the medical condition is now cleared up, but of course the physical one will never clear. So we're going to stop that. You can object if you like and have appeal." I said, "Well, I know I'm getting better. I just hope I still get." They said, "We're sure you will." So it took an awful long time for that to go. But it did go in the end. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. But, of course, the shoulder is the same. But as I say, that was it. And my years of excitement had all ended.
What do you think now about having served in the Second World War?
Having
served in the Second World War?
Oh, I think it was necessary. I think if it hadn't been through chaps that I knew who gave their lives, and myself to an extent, and other people like that, then the Germans would have mastered us, and this would have been the hell on earth that I saw in Poland and other places. Because wherever the German boot was, the people there had been treated worse than animals. And they took their vengeance out on the German people of Arnhem, didn't they? Starved them to death, most of them.
The Dutch people.
The Dutch people, yeah. I mean, the Dutch family I know, the mother and father survived, and one of the girls survived, but the other one, because of eating boiled tulips for food, you know, which has no food value at all, she got weaker and weaker, developed TB and died. And she must have been about 15, 16 years of age, that's all. So I think it was necessary and it was done. And Germany was smashed, and if it hadn't been smashed by now, we'd have had another one on the way, I'm sure of that. In a way, it's the same with Japan. The bombs really knocked them for a burden. But, of course, since then, there's been these minor skirmishes, and they're going on still in the Balkans.
How reliable do you think your memories are?
Very good on these things. I remember the things that stand out in my memory. I don't remember the time of day. I don't remember whether I had any food that day. I do remember I was damned hungry, and that sometime after the event I did get some potatoes somewhere, which was food. And other events are like something that someone said or something that happened at that split moment. But beyond that, I mean, I consider my story to be absolutely reliable.
Because some people think the human memory is unreliable.
That's right, yeah, but that part of my memory can... I can never shut my memory to certain things, and possibly the most important one was the Russian officer and his horse. It was so... I once described it to someone as being like some bit of opera on the stage at Covent Garden, because here was I... skinny and dressed in rags, these troops going by in this awful weather, freezing cold, and there was this chap, and from his boots up, he looked as though he was on stage, because his uniform and his overcoat were immaculate. And he's looking at me and laughing, and you almost expect him to start singing. No, it's reliable, everything I've said.